This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Here's a little secret about the media business. Whenever there's a big breaking story, reporters start working fast, trying to get interviews and background information, and folks in charge of the digital end of things are working just as hard to find images to accompany the story. And sometimes, I'm sure you've noticed this, there are stock images that come up again and again, especially if there's something exciting and resonant about those images. We've been looking at the image of the COVID-19 virus that has accompanied so many stories that we're sure you've seen in the past few weeks and months, and we've been wondering about its qualities. Deborah Gamuccio is Professor Emerita of Cell and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan, and she's also the director of something called the Bioartography Project that takes images from researchers' science and converts them into beautiful works of art. She has some thoughts on COVID and its depiction and joins us now. Deb Gamuccio, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much for having me, April. It's a delight.
Will you tell us a little bit about how some of the images that we see of something as tiny as a virus, how those images are made?
Well, they're actually structurally pretty accurate. So the first images that are taken are typically of viruses using an electron microscope, which is something that can magnify things much greater than even a typical light microscope can. This particular virus is, I think it measures approximately 100 to 120 nanometers, and a nanometer would be 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter. So for example, a human hair is about 75,000 nanometers, and so that would mean that you'd need a little over 600 virus particles to span the width of a human hair. So that's how tiny it is. You have to see it under electron microscope. And there, under those kinds of scopes, all the images are black and white. And they're a little bit fuzzy as well. So what the artist did was took pretty much the shape of what they saw under the electron microscope and then added some colors and a little bit more detail to make it look striking as an image. So those big red spikes that you typically see, those are really there. You can see those in the electron microscope. And those are actually part of the virus particle that attaches to cells and allows the virus to gain entry to the cells. And then they put on a bunch of other little colored dot on the virus envelope that you can see. Those are just representing various proteins. So that you really, the real virus doesn't have any color. It's pretty much just transparent. But the image gives you the impression of an entire thing that has some, you know, some substance to it that you can grab, that you can mentally deal with.
So if I'm getting you, the virus itself, the structure that we see is pretty accurate, but it's the color aspects in this case that are, shall we say, man-made.
That's right. That's right.
What do you observe in people's reaction to this image? My 10-year-old took one look at it and was like, oh, it's a poof ball.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've heard everything from, you know, speck of dust type thing to alien spaceship. They have made it in the dark red colors give it kind of a sinister look, at least to me. And I've heard other people react in the same way. In this case, the image is just an image of the virus, but I'm not sure how much the branding or the use of the image has helped the people understand more about the virus and what they can do to avoid it.
That's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I know that when a virus is named, there's a great deal of thought put into what the name should communicate about it. There has been an interest in recent years not to demonize places around the world which may or may not have anything to do with the virus's origins. Are you saying that there is some intention given to how representations of the virus should look and what they should tell us about it?
Yes, I think there is emphasis on how it should look. But what I guess I'm saying here is that when I look at that image of the virus, I see those red spikes as most prominent. And talking about names, the name comes from those red spikes. They look like a crown in the electron microscopes. So corona is the word for crown, right? But when you look at that particular image, I don't think the image by itself tells the people much more than, oh, this is an approximate indication of what the virus actually looks like. What could be conveyed if there was more, let's say, verbiage typically done with the coronavirus presentations, is they could say, okay, those spikes are made of protein. That protein dissolves in soap or hand sanitizer. If you wash your hands and use hand sanitizer regularly, you can get that those viruses, you can kill the viruses, basically.
Is there any chance at this point for us to, shall we say, alter? I mean, is the brand ripe for a reboot? Are there ways that, you know, future generations of imagery around COVID could possibly communicate that information?
It's possible. Even, for example, if you took that and then put a few words around the virus that just says destroy this protein or something, wash your hands, destroy this protein, something that would give people a little bit more information about how they can defeat it.
How do you think the shape of it, how do you think it works as a sort of artifact of design?
Well, I think, again, it's quite an accurate depiction of what the virus is. And if many people are actually getting more adept at going online and finding out things, and certainly you can go online and learn a little bit more about the coronavirus. You can learn, for example, about these spikes and how they are the way that the virus gets into the cell. You can learn that the whole envelope of the virus is made up of protein, and that protects the so-called brain of the virus, which is just a single strand of nucleic acid, in this case, ribonucleic acid. And that's what the virus is using to tell the cell to make more of itself. So you can go online and you can learn these kinds of things. The representation doesn't necessarily tell you much about that. It does give you the sense of what the virus looks like. It does give you this sense of reaction, either a fuzzy ball, which is a little bit scary to me. I wouldn't want to hug my virus, or an alien spaceship, which might be a little bit more fearful in most people. But it doesn't tell you more about the biology of the virus. It doesn't tell you how tiny the virus is. The image actually gives you an impression it's fairly large.
Right.
Because it has a lot of parts on it, right? But it's not.
Let's talk a little bit about how bioartography has taken certain images and made them go viral in a little bit different way. For those who don't know the story, could you tell us about the origins of the project?
Well, sure. Thank you. It was started back in 2005. Sue O'Shea, who's a professor of cell and developmental biology, and Kim Lim, who's an assistant professor in cell and developmental biology research track, and I were kind of daydreaming one day about the fact that we had so many beautiful images that we take on a daily basis, but we had never used those images. We actually react to those images very viscerally. Like we see an image of bone marrow and it's absolutely beautiful. And so we were saying, well, what would happen if we took these images and we matted and framed them and sold them as art and then used the money as a fundraiser to help our trainees travel to meetings and meet with their peers and be able to present their work and network. And so that kind of the idea took off. And for the very first years, we actually did all the matting and framing ourselves. We got into the Ann Arbor Art Fair, and about 40 volunteers every year would help us man the booths and sell everything. But then what we realized from that is that the images are not just good for fundraising. they're also this amazing tool to communicate to the public the newer aspects of biomedical research, answering questions like, why is it reasonable to use a fruit fly to study human colon cancer or Down syndrome? Why? What are human embryonic stem cells and how are they being used and why should we not be afraid of them? So there's a lot of information we can give, both with the image, but in our case, in contrast to the coronavirus, every one of our images is sold with a paragraph which tells about the image and its implications and a little bit about the research project that underlies the actual taking of that image under the microscope.
You mentioned bone marrow. Do you have other favorites?
Oh, well, my favorite's in the intestine. It's gorgeous. And I've studied it most of my research career, so I guess I can't. That's my top favorite. The brain, of course, neurons in general. Neurons come in all kinds of shapes, sizes. They communicate with other cells. And I guess for me, one of the central messages here is communication. Communication that we can do with the public, communication that cells do to each other, communication that the coronavirus does to our cells and things like that. So to me, communication is kind of the central hub here.
I couldn't help but notice that bioartography has taken advantage of the moment by adding a line of masks to its product list. Can you tell me what some of the... What some images were that you chose for the line of masks?
Right. Well, we're exploring this territory. The background here is that we had some help from Christiane Myers, who's actually in the School of Theater and Music at Michigan. And she and I held a joint project last summer, which involved making silk scarves. Putting our images onto silk scarves, and we sold those at the art fair and did quite well. So Christiane suggested this year that we should make masks. And indeed, she has fabric artists that can help, and she helped us get this all in line. We chose two images for starting out the project, one of which is actually a fetal lung of a mouse, which kind of shows how the air spaces are growing together with the capillaries, because in the end, your lung has to be really, really close to your blood. Your air spaces have to be very close to your blood capillaries, and this starts in fetal life. And the other one is actually a picture of some bacteria. Those particular ones happen to be cyanobacteria, so they're not really something that we breathe in the air, but the mask does look like it has bacteria swarming all over it.
Are these not the same ones that lead to toxic blooms in the lakes in the summer?
They are. They exactly are. Those are fascinating bacteria because they actually fix over 50% of the carbon dioxide in the air. So, and we don't know how they do it. So the bacteria are smarter than we are, just like the virus is. And so people at the University of Michigan, Anthony Beccarelli in the in molecular cell and developmental biology department is studying those bacteria quite avidly to try to understand how they fix carbon dioxide. And he's where we got the images from.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know if I'm ready to put the bacterial image so right on my face. It's just a little too nerve-wracking. That one with the alveoli is really beautiful. I'm going to opt for that one. Have you had many takers on the mask line?
Well, we've sold about two-thirds of almost three-quarters of our stock that we got in the first round. And we're putting in another order for more material. So, yeah, it seems to be doing pretty well.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about how creativity comes into the process of making images like this?
Oh, at many points. So when you think back, these are images, for example, that we have, are all images taken during the course of research. So research is basically a creative process. You take a lot of facts that are known And then you try to jiggle those facts and put them together in a different way and project what might be a new truth. And to then test whether that new truth is correct or not, you do experiments. And the microscope is one way that you visualize the results of your experiment. So that whole, there's a whole creativity in planning. Then there's a creativity in how you take the picture under the microscope. You want to show carefully what your anomaly is or what your normalcy is in some cases. And you have to be very careful about how you take your images. And then finally, in the case of us, we do manipulate those images further using Photoshop, and we try to make them even more striking so that they'll grab the eye of the public. And we have help with that, because what we do is manipulate a bunch of images. We make multiple versions and we take them to artists in the art school, and they pick out the most striking images. And so those are the ones that we always go with every single year. So at multiple stages, there's a creative process going on that in the end is the image that you see in bioartography.
Deb, I think a lot of people have this erroneous idea that scientists don't really use much creativity in their work. What is it like for the folks who've been collaborating on bioartography to have this outlet?
Yeah, I think one of the, first of all, I guess the first part of the statement I think is outright wrong in terms of the way people think about scientists. As they think about scientists, they think about data. And it's true that data forms the basis for our understanding of things. But to get to the next step, to go beyond what is known and what the data tell us now, to project what the data might mean for a fact that we don't yet know, that's what the creativity is all about. We have to come up with ideas in our brain to think about what this data might be telling us that it's not there on the page, but we have to put it together in a different way and become creative. And then we can design experiments to test whether our various creative ideas are right or wrong. So it's science is absolutely all about creativity. On the other hand, what bioartography does, I think, is utilize that creativity to communicate to the public.
Deborah Gamuccio is Professor Emerita in Cell and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Bioartography Project. Deb, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, April. I really appreciate it. Please stay safe.
You too.